When I drew up the sheets inviting folk to suggest which questions they'd like us to tackle, I deliberately put is Christian sexual morality not out of date down at the bottom in the hope that nobody would get that far. And on the way down the list, we'd find other things that they would be interested in asking about or talking about, and I wouldn't have to try and work out what to say. It was only the third favourite choice, I suppose, so that's perhaps says something about something. I'm not quite sure what. The one advantage does give me the chance to tell my minister sex joke. Do you want to hear it? You sure? Because if you don't want to hear it, I'll not tell you. And some of you... some of you might have heard it before. But... It's about the minister who was just fed up with his congregation, a purely apocryphal story, obviously, but just completely fed up with his congregation because he never paid any attention to a word that he said. He felt at the end of every service he could have been talking about anything for all the difference it made. The sermons just didn't grip them. And he came home one time in frustration and said to his wife, "I'm just fed up with that congregation. I preach to them from the Bible every week and they don't react at all. I'd be as well preaching my sermons about going sailing or something." And his wife consoled him and said, "They're doing your best and whatever." And he was sitting in the study that week wondering what to preach about the following Sunday and decided for whatever reason that he would do a sermon on sex. And he prepared it, and he worked it out, and he went along to church, and he preached it, and it was brilliant. And folk were absolutely enthralled by it. They sat on the edge of their seats. It was biblical, it was witty, it was challenging, it was relevant, it was helpful. And afterwards, they were all over him. They couldn't stop talking about what he'd said and how it had helped them and all the rest of it. And so it happened that his wife wasn't there that Sunday. She was away at some Women's Institute rural cake baking competition or something. And the following day, he met somebody from the church who just came up to her and said, "That sermon your husband preached on Sunday, it was absolutely brilliant." And his wife, not having quite caught up with all that happened over the weekend, said, That's really strange. I didn't think he knew anything about the subject." He said, "He's only ever done it twice before. Once was in the ferry to Arran, and his cap blew off. And the other time was with some of his friends from university, and he was sick over the side." I'm pleased you laughed. I did actually tell that joke as an introduction to a sermon one 10 years ago, and there was only silence. So either my joke telling has improved, or else the congregation has loosened up a bit. But I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to tell the story. Christian sexual morality out of date? The Bible is very positive about the whole question of sex right from the beginning. If you read the Genesis chapter 1 account of creation, where it says, and we very often refer to the fact that it says God created human beings, or created man, in his own image. And we go on to reflect quite a lot on what it means to be made in the image of God. But what it actually says is that he created them in his own, created mankind in his own image, male and female, he created them. So right from the start, the image of God is not just our humanness, but our identity as men and women, if you like, beside each other, male and female, he created them. And that's immediately followed by the instruction to go forth and multiply in the old translations of the Bible, to go and populate the earth, to have children, to procreate. And if you don't know how that happens, then you probably shouldn't be here this evening in the first place. So right from the start, that question of reproduction or procreation is what we do in the image of God who is the creator in the first place. So it's not something that the Bible is ashamed about or shy or bashful about. And it goes on in Genesis chapter 2, which is the second part of the creation story, to unpack that a little bit, about how the male and female were created and how it came about that they were to partner in that particular way. And it talks about the two becoming one as the physical act, if you like, but does or sets that in its social context. It says, so a man leaves his father and his mother and is joined to his wife, and the two become one. So sex is in there right from the start as something that's part of creation. It's there and it's good, but it's there in its social context of two people living their whole lives together. It's not an activity in isolation, but part of that bigger picture. And it's in the context also of family units. So the command is given to go forth and multiply, or to go and have children. But if you're to ask the Bible the question, how long does it take to have children, then the answer would not be 10 minutes behind the bike shed, nor would it be 9 months while the baby's in its mother's womb. It would be for the whole of somebody's childhood. It's a whole process of not just conceiving a child or bearing a child, but bringing up a child, preparing them or sharing with that young person to whom you have been given and who has been given to you, sharing your life with them. So the social context and the family context is where the Bible places sexual relationships, and not anywhere else. But that expanded picture of Genesis chapter 2 about the two becoming one is what Jesus goes on to pick up on himself in Matthew chapter 19. He quotes those verses from the Old Testament, from Genesis, from the creation story, and uses them as the basis for New Testament morality. So it's very much written into there. The Bible has a positive attitude about sex. And when it goes on in other contexts to describe where sex fits in, it's not with a view to preventing sex from happening, as if it was a kind of tut-tut thing that shouldn't ever be done if at all possible, or only on very regrettable occasions. Quite the opposite, in fact. What the Bible does is protects sex. It says, here is something that's so precious or so important that we've got to make sure we don't damage it or abuse it. So that incident in Matthew chapter 19 I've just referred to, where Jesus spoke about the two becoming one from the Genesis picture and used that as the basis for sexual morality in his day, he was using it in the context of a question about divorce. And Jesus said, no, don't divorce. And particularly was saying to men, don't get rid of one wife in order to go and find yourself another one, because sex is too important to be treated in that kind of throwaway fashion. Similarly, in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus speaks very passionately about the sin of adultery and says, not only should you not do it, you should even pull yourself up when you find yourself thinking about doing it, because sex is too important to be trivialized, even imagination. And the other famous one, where Jesus is brought to Jesus, a woman caught in the act of adultery, and he famously asks the folk, any who are without sin, throw the first stone. And nobody was willing to. So in that context of sexual sin, there was nobody there who felt that they could absolve themselves of blame. So he said to the woman, I don't condemn you. He also said to her, go and sin no more. So what you've been doing is wrong, not because sex is wrong, but because the trivializing of sex, or the debasing of it, of sex is wrong. It's too important or precious a thing to be damaged. And there's another example in John chapter 4. I don't know whether you've noticed it before, but in the story of the Samaritan woman, when Jesus eventually says to her, go and get your husband so that we can talk about this together. And the woman says, oh, I have no husband, flutters her eyelashes and pretends to be a blushing virgin. And Jesus says, no, that's right, you don't have a husband. You've had 5 husbands, but the man that you're living with now is not your husband. So which is a comment, you know, sometimes folk will say, ah, well, living together in a kind of committed relationship is just the same as marriage. But Jesus made the distinction between the two. You've had 5 husbands, but the man you're having sex with now is not your husband. And again, he wasn't wanting to say to her that sex was wrong, but that the way that she was doing it was an abuse of something good, a spoiling of something precious. And again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul is talking about a problem of prostitution. Some folks in the church were using the services of prostitutes, quite possibly in a kind of pagan temple context, temple prostitution. But Paul says to them, you can't do that, because any time you have sex, the two become one. You see, he takes the language of Genesis chapter 2, where sex is exalted, and says it's because it's such an exalted thing that you should not debase it to the level of prostitution. He doesn't say sex is a dirty, horrid thing, you should have nothing to do with it. He says sex is such a precious thing. But there's no alternative to the very best form in which it comes, if you like. And to try and reduce it is, in fact, to reduce yourself in that way. So these are all examples of when not to have sex, not because sex itself is bad, but because it's too good to spoil. Now, as a church, we need to recognize the fact that that's not always been the message that's been put across. There's been a great deal of confusion, and the impression has very often been given that sex is a kind of muddy, dirty thing or a regrettable necessity. At times in its history and different places, the church has exalted celibacy, voluntary abstinence from sex, as if that somehow made people purer or better. So it was only those who were weak who gave in and got married, but those who were strong Christians or faithful believers would abstain or take vows of chastity as part of a higher or more exalted calling. And the Bible doesn't support that view either. At other times, the Bible, or the church rather, almost spoke as if sin itself was a sexually transmitted disease. It's because we are conceived through sexual intercourse that we become sinners. And that led to all sorts of absurdities. Apparently Origen, at one point, who was a second century-ish church leader, came up with a theory that if it hadn't been for the fall, then God would have found some alternative method to produce children than sexual intercourse. So sex only happens as a result of the fall, and otherwise we would presumably all have been getting bits of ribs extracted or growing children in some other way like that. The Catholic Church still holds to the doctrine of Mary's Immaculate Conception, which is that somehow or other, when Mary was conceived inside her mother's womb, something extra happened to her to protect her from sin being transmitted to her through her parents, through her mother, through her parents, in order that she could then be pure enough to be the mother of Jesus and not defile him by his virgin birth. And these are all notions for which there is no real biblical support at all, or very obscure interpretations of parts of the Bible to really read in to the Bible story that sex is bad, and therefore the less of it that we should have, the better. At other times it's kind of said, yes, that sex is a necessary evil and people have to do it to have children, but if they're going to do it, they certainly shouldn't enjoy it, because that's not what it's for in the first place. And all of that is clearly very difficult to hold alongside a Bible which includes among its books the Song of Songs, which is a sexually explicit celebration of that kind of human relationship. And if you read it with any imagination at all, you can see exactly what's going on and what's being celebrated. Now, scholars have often debated what the purpose of the Song of Songs is in the Bible, and sometimes in the past we've been told, well, it's not really about two human beings falling in love and entering into a sexual relationship. It's really an allegory for God's love for the world, or God's love for the church, or something of that sort. But actually, if you think about it, that makes it even more absurd in any way to downgrade sex or to say it's not something that the Bible approves of. If it's used in the Bible as an allegory for the way that God loves us, if God is seen as the lover in that song, then it's hard to berate the act itself. So the Bible is very positive about sex, but what it doesn't do is exalt sex as a separate thing, either from its social family context that we mentioned earlier, or from a relationship with God. That happens in other religions. Sex is exalted. In other religions, particularly Islam, there is a picture of heaven described in very erotic terms. Certainly if you're a man. If you're a woman, it's maybe not so good, but if you're a man, then heaven is full of all these blushing virgins waiting to receive you and share their favours upon you. In contrast to which, Jesus says of heaven when he was asked that, well, there actually won't be any marriage in heaven. The dead will rise to life, but they will not marry. So heaven, when it's described in superlative terms, is described in other terms. There isn't that exalting of sex to some kind of sublime status. And as an alternative to that, we have lots of stuff in the Bible describing heaven in terms of the wedding feast of the Lamb, or the church as the bride of Christ. So the wedding language itself, the marriage language itself, with all the sex that's implicit in it, is itself exalted to another level and used to describe our relationship with Jesus. So in that eternal context, sex is not exalted. And similarly, the Bible resists the exalting of sex on earth as the only kind of fulfillment. If you read the papers or talk to your friends or watch films or whatever, then the impression that we're given today is that sex is the only thing that really matters. Whatever else you do with your life, you're a failure if you're not triumphant sexually. And you are unfulfilled or incomplete or disappointed as long as that area of your life doesn't work out. And that's a message which has been dominant in Western society for the last 40 years or more, but particularly since the 60s with the sexual revolution. And in some senses, where we are today in society, have the advantage of being able to see through the absolute nonsense of that way of life, because during the time when we have been focused so much on this form of fulfillment, I think sex and the relationships that go with it have never actually been more disappointing. And you can look at the statistics for divorce, which have trebled in the last 10 or 20 years, for disillusion. If you listen to the love songs that make it into the whatever charts, they're all songs about disappointed lovers, broken-hearted lovers, very few celebrating the joy and the fulfillment of the thing. And medical research has discovered, disappointingly but repeatedly, the increase in sexually transmitted diseases that there has been in our society, in Western society, over the last number of years, with significant pain and suffering caused as a result of the way that we live our lives. So although on the one hand we are surrounded by a very permissive attitude which makes anybody who tries to stick to the Christian sexual moral code feel out of place and criticised and very difficult to express their point of view in public, actually those who defend what goes on have very little to draw on to suggest that there is a worthwhile or a rewarding or a fulfilling way of life there. Now for us as Christians, it's not time to say with a wagging finger, "I told you so," and to smile triumphantly because we got it right and they got it wrong. This is an area of huge suffering and pain, emotional and social disappointment and destruction, and it's something that we should be very lovingly and tenderly concerned about. But to appreciate that when we're talking about sexual ethics, we're not just talking about what is right for me or what's going to make me feel good or how I'm going to fulfill my potential as a human being. We're talking about the whole way that society works and how families and individuals and people at every level and in every generation are being crushed and broken because they're not living their lives according to the standard that has been set. So what the Bible does say is sex is a great thing. It's part of a social and family relationship, but it also takes second place to higher purposes. Within the Bible, marriage is always a tool used by God to enable people to get or to do their best in his service. It's never the ultimate goal, simply to get married. the pictures of a man and a woman being able to help each other, but help to do something, helped in the service of God. A couple, when they get married, should be more effective together as kingdom builders, as witnesses or evangelists or servants, than they would have been if they had remained apart. It's not a case of them saying, look, we don't need to go and do anything useful for society anymore because we're going to fulfill ourselves by having sex all the time and that's all that there is to our lives. And most clearly, the place of sex is seen in the Bible when we come to Jesus himself, who is someone who never married, who never experienced a physical sexual relationship, and yet was perfect and fulfilled and exalted by God. So the contemporary picture that says the only way to find fulfillment is by doing something that the only perfect man never did is clearly lacking somewhere along the line. But having said all of those things about the high and exalted place that the Bible view that the Bible sex within its proper place in society and community, we need also to say that the Bible is not afraid of sex and not defeated by sex. And if you go through all the heroes of the Old Testament who are often held up to us as biblical role models, then what we find is examples of almost every possible sexual sin under the sun. Abraham slept with his maidservant Hagar because his wife wasn't producing a child. Jacob picked up, he was too drunk on his first wedding night to recognize that he'd married the wrong woman, so he then married again. And we know all about the social family problems that resulted for him there. When we go into the next generation, we have got the figure of Joseph very properly running away from the bed of Potiphar's wife and refusing to commit adultery with her. But in parallel to that, we have his big brother Judah sleeping with someone whom he thought was a prostitute, but who was in fact his daughter-in-law, and she giving birth to twins. In the next generation, we have Rahab, who is a prostitute, who also works her way into the royal family. And then we have Israel's greatest ever king, who was David, who committed adultery with Bathsheba, and whose son Solomon was polygamous with a multitude of wives. So when you go through the heroes of the Old Testament, you find these multitude of sexual sins. We find very often the damaging consequences of all of that. But what we don't find is God saying, that's just so disgusting, I can't put up with this anymore, I'm not having any more to do with you. So we have a moral code that defines a right standard for sexual behavior, but which also forgives the mistakes that people make, that produces consequences that are often painful when things are done wrong, but never in to such an extent that God can't rescue or redeem the situation. So the right standard is there, but the righteousness of Christ, the forgiveness, the repair, the reinstatement, the future, is always presented as a further possibility. So if you ask the question, is Christian sexual morality out of date? Well, the answer could be yes, if by Christian sexual morality we mean the sexual morality which has sometimes prevailed in our churches, where we have thought that sex itself was a dirty, smutty word and we should have nothing to do with it. That's out of date. The answer is also yes if we relate it to the world around us, to contemporary society. What the Bible says is very different from what is practiced in our little corner today. It's different in other parts of the world and at other times in history. But I think it's not out of date if you want to be in step with a God who loves you, with a God who cares so much about us that having given us this wonderful gift, he then wants us to make the most of it, to use it in the best possible way, but also to understand its limitations and to know that there are other things, there are better things that can be done in this life and that can be looked forward to in the next.